The Guardian.
I'm James Randerson, and this is Science Weekly for March the 17th. We've got a cracker of a show for you this week. We'll discuss science, fiction and lab lit with our special guest, science writer and biologist Dr. Jennifer Roan. Also in the show...
It's time for science to grab us by the scruff of the neck and shake us from our pointless torpor.
Biology or Beowulf? Maths or media studies? Comedian Robin Ince gives us his thoughts on the merits of science versus the arts. Plus...
Then the paper came out of that, and it was called Scrotal Asymmetry in Man and in Ancient Sculpture.
We go behind the scenes at the Ig Nobel Awards show to hear about the links between country music and suicide, the dangers of sword swallowing, and scrotal asymmetry. Ouch. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. It's a science and literature special this week, so without further ado, let me introduce our esteemed panel of thesps and sudes. Ian Sample is The Guardian's science correspondent, and he's just about to go on a month-long holiday. Sorry, sabbatical. Now, Ian, you're only allowed to take one book away with you. What will it be?
Douglas Coupland's Gum Thief, by the looks of things.
I don't know that book.
I've only read two pages, nor do I yet.
Also in the pod... Nell Bowes is from the Guardian's arts team. Will you be curling up with a classic tome this weekend or some airport trash?
I'll actually be in an airport on my way to New York, so it'll probably be trash.
Oh, you're so glam. Well, we're all for blurring the lines here between science and the arts, and our special guest this week is similarly minded. Dr. Jennifer Roan is a cell biologist at University College London, where she's done research into virology, cancer and gene therapy. You could call that the day job, though, because Jenny's also a prolific science writer, novelist and blogger, and the founding editor of lablit.com. On her website, it says you'll find her at most London science/art/culture/lit events. Why has it taken us so long to get you on the show, Jenny? Welcome to the pod.
Thank you very much.
So, what's all this Lablit about?
Well, I love reading, and I love reading about realistic professions and situations. And I realized there weren't any stories about scientists out there. There's science fiction and fantasy, but those don't usually have much to do with modern-day science. It wasn't until I stumbled across a book by Carl Gerassi called Cantor's Dilemma, which is about a biochemist doing real experiments in a lab, that I realized how strange it was that there's this complete void in literature today. I mean, try to think. Can any of you think of three books with realistic scientist characters in them off the top of your head?
Well, probably anything by Michael Crichton, anything by Kurt Vonnegut, and anything by Douglas Adams.
I feel we're struggling a little bit.
You're struggling a bit. There aren't that many. In fact, on the website, I've compiled a list, and there's about 100 novels on it in total, ever written, that contain realistic scientists plying their trade as part of the plot.
People often cite Ian McEwan as being a novelist who treats science quite well, but... We were talking about this earlier, that his characters aren't actually scientists,
are they?
No,
there's a science writer, and obviously there's a neuroscientist.
In Saturday.
He's a
neurosurgeon.
A neurosurgeon.
Yeah.
Who clearly states, oh, I'm not a scientist. I just yank out tumors.
Yes.
So it's very peculiar.
Very sophisticated mechanic.
No, I just feel it's a bit odd, right? Because science is so central to our lives. Science is everywhere. It's saturating the media. Every day you hear about the latest science story or the latest science scare. But if you go to Waterstones and try to read a book about sort of realistic scientists, you will draw a blank. If you go to Waterstones now, these 100 books, only about 20 of them are still in print.
So what solution have you come up with?
So Lablit, you see, is my cunning plan to get people to think more about this thing. I decided to do a little experiment, Waterstones. I said, would you let me put these books out on a table and see if people will buy them? And so they said, they thought it was really weird, but they'd let me do it. I cobbled together 20 books and we put a big poster about it, lab lit. And they left it up for 5 months because it was so successful. People were just gobbling it up. It's a traditional publishing industry, which is comprised of arts and humanities graduates who may not really like science, and maybe they've been avoiding science all their life. And these are the people who make decisions about what novels get published. And I've talked to a lot of lab-lit authors who have got these comments back from the editor saying, this is a great story, great characters. I was really intrigued to learn about the science, but I don't think people want to read about science, so we won't be buying your novel. So I think there needs to be a change. I think that people, I think people do want to read about science, even non-scientists.
It's a good job Ben Goldacre is not in the room, because he'd probably start on about the kind of analogous situation in the media, but let's not go there. I think, you know, CSI, for example, has proved that scientific characters can be really successful in
popular culture. Yeah, definitely. And CSI, I mean, hats off to them. You may not like the show, it may not be your cup of tea, but it's done amazing things for the image of scientists. And I think it's not just, Lablet is not just concerned with novels, but also with films and TV. And I think this is a great subversive and viral way to get science on the agenda. If you put it in fiction, people will gobble it up. I mean, who's going to go to a science museum? Maybe some school kids. Is that really going to change anything? But if you have a really successful program with sexy scientists, you know, acting like real human beings and, you know, not destroying the world but actually doing good things, it could do a lot for the image of science.
Nell, you've got a question.
To me, it seems like there's two things here as well. There's having scientists as characters, and then there's actually science being part of the story, and I can't work out which one it is that you're keen on. They seem to be very different things.
I think there's room for both. I mean, it's quite nice to have scientist characters, but if they're just there and they're not doing anything scientific, it becomes a sort of a contrived add-on thing. Oh, let's just have a scientist character. It is nice when they're doing their profession, but you have to be a really skilled writer to portray the world and the activities without boring the audience or becoming dumping a lot of exposition on them. So I think it's a unique challenge. There's never going to be a Lablet section in a bookstore. It's never going to be a huge genre. But I think there's room for more than 100 books about scientists.
Have you got an example of a book that has done this really well?
Yeah, I think that my favorite at the moment is a book called Intuition by Allegra Goodman. This is set in a lab in Boston. And the author basically shadowed some scientists for a couple of weeks and then wrote a really great fraud plot about this lab, based on this lab. So a guy has some dodgy dealings and he tries to cover it up. It was a really interesting human story because it's how the lab reacts when one of their member accuses the other member of fraud. And the lab just begins to unravel. And it's a real psychological thriller. And it's deeply interesting. And it was really authentic. They had, I don't know how she did it. She could have fooled me. I mean, I thought she was a scientist when I read it. She had everything down, the personalities, the sort of the bitchy conversations, the competition, the passions and the angst, to be honest. You know, there's a lot of angst in science. And she really pinned it. And it was a really interesting book. And I think books like that, a book like that couldn't have been written in any other profession, I think, because science has these unique features.
I just want to move you on to some of the other things that you're into. On the blogging side of things, you have I think you described it earlier on as a very confessional blog. I'm not suggesting you necessarily want to bare your heart now, but what are you trying to achieve with your blogging, and what do you think scientific bloggers have been able to achieve?
Well, so that's two different questions. I think when you hear the word science blog, most of you probably think of a person who's writing about the facts and figures of science. And there's lots of these science bloggers out there, and they're very good. They're very talented. They're basically doing a science journalism job for free, maybe in a bit more in-depth than some. Nothing against you, Ian. You're very good. But, you know, a lot of science writers will write a three-paragraph thing, and that's their science piece for the day. These people really get in-depth. They're not constrained by print, so they can put all the details in. That, to me, is a bit boring because I'm more interested in the culture behind
science. It's not really using the medium, is it?
Yeah.
In a sense.
I mean, the original meaning of blog, it was a web diary. And there's a lot of, in a way, the science blogging community has become a bit hostile toward people like me who just want to talk about the lifestyle. I don't want to talk about the facts and figures. I think about them all day long. And if you want to know the facts and figures, there are many places where you can go to learn them. But if you want to learn about, be a fly on the wall in the lab and learn about what actually happens in those four walls, I think more scientists should be out there explaining what it's like to be a scientist.
No.
I was going to add, do you also appreciate and think there's also a middle ground on science blogging of that kind of methods of how did it go, what did you do, what techniques did you use that isn't necessarily straight facts and figures because it's much more experiential, it's more
functional.
Yeah,
helpful.
Helpful, and you can actually have a kind of forum of why isn't this test, you know, coming up right, and or why aren't we able to replicate this result?
So then your audience are scientists who want to improve their techniques.
Mm-hmm.
And that, there's definitely a place for that. I don't want to diss these people. I think the science bloggers are great. I love what they're doing. I just don't want to read it. And I think a lot of non-scientists might be a bit more interested in the lifestyle than in the facts and figures. Or if they got into the lifestyle, they might start thinking, science is quite interesting. Maybe I'll read one of these blogs about, you know, why are plants green.
Quick question from Ian.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. I'm going to bite on this whole confessional aspect of it. What, have you said anything that's really made you or other people wince?
Yes. Well, no, I've never mentioned names. So I talk about my laboratory, and someone could work out where I was, and they could probably work out who I'm talking about, but I never mention names. I don't think that's fair. I do sometimes think, I wonder if my boss is reading this. And once I was applying for a very prestigious grant where they expect you to be really gung-ho, and I was writing a post about how I like to go home at 6 because I like to have a sort of a 9-to-5 existence. And then I thought, oh, God, what if the grant funding committee is reading this blog and they think I'm not serious? So it is a bit weird blogging. And sometimes I feel like there's nobody listening. But I get loads of comments and things.
Do you get nice comments or a bit of a mixture?
See, I blog in Nature Network London, which is a very friendly place, and it's very protected. All the science, and you can't be anonymous on Nature Network London, so that really restrains people. It's really nice.
I'm interested in what role bloggers can sort of play in moving on the cause, if you like, or almost doing a bit of journalism as well. And I think some of them are starting to do it. A couple of months ago, PZ Myers on his Pharyngula blog came out with some really interesting stuff about a proteomics paper that was talking about the mighty creator and how mitochondria were linked to the soul. It was just hilarious, and we wrote about it at the time. And there have been other examples as well. Do you think bloggers are going to do more of that sort of thing, more investigation, because they kind of have got the time and the obsession to do it?
I think that you will get more exposés. If bloggers are reading the literature and they have more time to write than a journalist, then they will be finding the literature is full of things like that example that you just gave. I used to be an editor for a journal, and we got all sorts. And sometimes the referees are too busy to catch it, and these weird things slip through. And personally, I think it's always been like that. It always will be like that. And if somebody catches you and puts it, sort of posts it for all to see, that's a good thing. But I think the scientific system is self-correcting, and these wackos will always be, will fade into obscurity anyway. Okay. But no, it's good. It's good that people are out there really paying attention and putting it live. I think that's great.
Okay, well, let's wrap that up there. Thanks very much, everyone. Jenny's sticking around for the rest of the show, and you can find out more about LabLit by going handily to lablit.com. I'm James Randerson, and you're listening to Science Weekly from The Guardian. Still to come, comedian Robin Ince gives us his take on C.P. Snow's lament about the two cultures in this week's Thought for the Pod. Plus,
you take any old water, and I'm talking filthy, disgusting water that stinks.
What you're putting in there now is really not like a bottle of wine at all. It's got horrible bits of algae in it. And,
that's right. It's come from my pond, so you've got fish poo and everything else poo in there. It's pretty disgusting.
You can hardly see through the jug. It's not quite turning water into wine, but we'll hear from an inventor who's designed the device that turns gunk into drink. That's coming up. But first, let's find out about the other science stories making the headlines over the past 7 days. Here's Nell and Ian with your News Jam.
News Jam.
A robot on the International Space Station was paralysed on Friday by a software problem which prevented it getting power to its joints. The Canadian robot, known as Dexter, is designed to help astronauts avoid difficult and dangerous spacewalks for repairing the space station.
Bone fragments from a population of miniature humans have been discovered in the South Pacific. The remains of at least 25 adults, who lived between 1,000 and 3,000 years ago, were found scattered on the floor of two limestone caves on the tiny rock islands of Palau in Micronesia. Scientists who analysed the bones believe the humans evolved to be small after they were isolated on the island with few food resources.
Swarms of sugar-cubed-sized robots are being developed to undertake difficult and dangerous jobs such as exploring distant planets or cleaning up waste dumps. The Cimbrian project at the University of the West of England aims to build highly adaptable machines that can communicate with each other and cooperate to solve problems.
And finally, veteran natural history broadcaster Sir David Attenborough warned last week of a silent natural disaster threatening butterfly species. To raise awareness of the problem, he is taking part in a £25 million project to build a butterfly theme park near St Albans. Butterfly World will incorporate a dome that is large enough to house Stonehenge 7 times over.
I don't believe that for a second. Sure it's true?
David Bellamy said it. It must be true.
authority of this show.
Okay. In all possible timbre. Thank you, Nell and Ian. Let's get quickly into a few of those. Now, I just can't believe that short people are in the news again on this pod. Ian, does this story have anything to do with The Hobbit? I mean, they were trying to push it, weren't they?
We know how the analysis of the Floris remains has gone on and on and on and on, and remeasurements and remeasurements.
Some people say they're human species.
Absolutely. Some people say they are just a sort of a small version of Homo sapiens with various types of disease and such like. So these are about 2,000 kilometres away on an island, a couple of very strange sort of mushroomy limestone islands about 2,000 miles away from Floris. And almost the entire inside of these limestone lumps are caves. And inside a couple of these, they found a lot of these remains, and they think they're probably burial grounds. But they were small. I mean, they actually quite bravely didn't put the heights of the people in the paper, because they said, look, it's just too hard to work out, but we can work out kind of what their mass was. And you're looking at sort of 40-odd kilos for a fully grown adult man, and about 20-odd kilos for the woman. Pretty damn tiny. But the interesting thing was that a lot of the morphologies of the bones were very similar, actually, to the Floris specimens. And so the guys are saying, look, we think these are still Homo sapiens. We're just saying that when you're trying to decide whether Floris is a new species or not, don't use these same measurements that we've got, because we're pretty confident that you can see that in humans when you just have them isolated on an island. Pretty few resources, because it's a hard island to get to, not many animals, and you can have the sort of the island dwarfism effect kick in, and these things end up as a pygmy population.
Jenny, have you sort of encountered this argument over the Floris fossils? It's a weird one to report on as a journalist, because it just swings back and forth.
I'm not an expert on this at all, but I think that the island dwarfism thing, it happens. I mean, there are documented cases with elephants and things. Mm. And if you don't have much food, I can surely see how that could happen. Maybe the Floris people were on holiday in Polynesia. I don't know. It's interesting, but it's so hard to piece together a scientific story when you don't have much data. And I know that everyone is desperate for an answer. You know, how tall were they? Are they human? But some things we just can't answer till we have more data.
I thought one thing that was quite interesting about these was that there were the earliest they found them was 1,500 years ago. And I said, well, look, they're on an island. Okay, it may be hard for big animals to get there, but they're on islands. They could fish. They would have plentiful resources.
Good point.
And but the guys I was interviewing said, well, yeah, but funnily enough, we think that the earliest sort of decent evidence of fishing capability came around the kind of time that these guys seem to have disappeared. So I don't know how tenuous that explanation is, but there's almost a suggestion that once you could fish, then you just grew up and got off there.
Well, miniature robots. This seems slightly disturbing. Swarms of miniature robots. I'm sure Prince Charles will be very uncomfortable. What do you think, Ian?
Well, I mean, obviously, Prince Charles has been misquoted in some context, actually, but also has been a bit concerned about grey goo nanorobots.
These aren't quite that small.
These aren't that small. These are not too small at all. They're sort of sugar lump sized. And it's the beginning of a project, so these guys have got an awful long way to go. But the concept what they're looking at is just distributed intelligence. They want to have, instead of one dedicated machine that is good at walking and digging up lumps of soil or whatever and doing something with it, like analysing if you're doing Martian exploration or something. This would be a collection of very small units that can talk to each other, can join together, and can change shape and form something. Now, the tricky thing is how they know what to be. And there are all manner of interesting software issues going on here about how you actually tell this thing, what its role in life is, how it then achieves that. And they're trying to use a lot of evolutionary programming techniques in sort of getting this thing to walk best and decide what to do. It's really strange stuff. And it's a really fascinating idea, the idea that you could have something that goes, you know, forms a ball, rolls along, comes across a wall, and then suddenly changes shape and grows legs and walks over it. It's a really nice idea, but at the moment they're nice simulations rather than nice realities.
On a completely different tack, Nell, you know about these butterflies. This is going to be bigger than the Eden project, isn't it?
About 26 acres is the idea. So the organisers reckon that you should have about 10,000 tropical butterflies in flight at any one time.
Wow. Wow.
But Ian doesn't believe that you can fit 7 Stonehenges in there.
Yeah, why the...
How much could they lift?
I don't understand the scepticism.
How many... 10,000 butterflies in flight at once? So yeah. If you harness them all together...
Harness the butterfly power.
Yeah, what could you lift?
Do you know what? I have the faintest idea. Last, like, give me an envelope.
I think there must be a kind of a climate change solution in there. We can harness the power of these tiny insects.
The flapping wind.
Exactly that.
Butterfly farm.
I think we should... Oh, actually, yeah, sorry. Ben, I have to ask this because Ben is incredibly excited about the etymology of the word butterfly. Do you actually have an answer for this?
Well, some people think that it used to be flutter by a sort of spoonerism that got turned around. But actually, they think that actually it's the most plausible explanation. It's actually Old English or Dutch from butterfly, butterfluga or something. I'm not sure my pronunciation is entirely correct because they were thought to steal milk.
Really?
Before they were kind of
who knew? Burgers.
Cheeky chappies.
Absolutely. Oh, there you go.
Well, Ben's looking very excited behind the glass there. I'm so glad we got that in. Well, thanks very much, everyone. If you want to make any comments on any of those stories, or maybe you've got a better etymology for the word butterfly, or maybe even some of the other words we've been using, why don't you put a comment on our Facebook wall or head to the science blog on blogs.guardian.co.uk/science.
Science Weekly.
And now on to altogether weightier matters. The 6th annual Ig Nobel Tour was in the UK last week, celebrating research that, in the words of their founder and friend of the pod, Mark Abrahams, first makes you laugh and then makes you think. Ian was there, and you can hear now how he got on.
I'm Brian Whitcomb. I'm a radiologist from Gloucester, and together with Dan Meyer, we wrote a paper on sword swallowing at side effects, which got us the Ig Nobel Medicine Award last year.
Dan, so you're a bona fide sword swallower.
I am. My name is Dan Meyer. I'm from Hartselle, Alabama. I'm the executive director of the Sword Swallowers Association International, and we did about a 2-year survey on all the sword swallowers worldwide, which is the basis for our paper.
I'm Chris McManus, and I'm professor of psychology and medical education at University College in London. I've long been interested in asymmetry and to why it is the two sides of the body and the two sides of the brain are different. And I'm also interested in art, and in fact, one of my interests at present is the psychology of art, and I've been interested in that for 30 years or so. And the great art historian Winckelmann at some point said that the works of art have natural beauty and they're asymmetric in the same way as the human body. And he gave us the example of the scrotum. And I happened to be on holiday. I had an extended holiday in Italy for about 6 weeks. I'd just finished my medical degree and I was waiting to start working in the NHS. And I wandered around art galleries and museums and I happened to have a little notebook and I happened to make a record of which way around there were. And at the end of the holiday, I looked and said, he's wrong. And so then the paper came out of that. And it was called Scrotal Asymmetry in Man and in Ancient Sculpture.
My name is Piers Barnes. I was lucky enough to be awarded the Ig Nobel Prize for Mathematics in 2007 for calculating the number of photos you need to take to make sure that nobody's blinking, or at least almost nobody's blinking.
It generally takes some sort of swallowers between 3 years and 7 years to learn. It took me 3 years practicing every day. We have a number of serious injuries each year, and several dozen more that go unreported each year. And most sword swallowing injuries, the serious ones, happen after a minor injury, or either that or while doing something very unusual, like having a parrot on your shoulder or swallowing multiple blades or curved blades or something like that.
To be quite explicit, in human males, the right testicle is both the higher but also the larger. And there's something rather illogical about that, having the larger one to be the higher. Mm. And what the Greeks did, they said that the one that's the higher, it must be the smaller, because, of course, the weight will pull the bigger one down.
Sure.
So they had a theory of gravity, if you like, but unfortunately it didn't correspond to the way nature actually was. And so we can see the way their minds were working and the error they were making, and that's where the paper came from.
How do you practice sword swallowing? I mean, do you sort of start off with sort of cutlery and then move up?
The first several months generally involves a lot of sore throats, a lot of abrasive wounds in the back of the throat, and it takes a long time to get past the gag reflex, first in the back of the throat, then finding the right opening, the right alignment to get the sword down, then relaxing the epiglottis and flipping it back, and relaxing the peristalsis reflex in the throat, sliding the blade down, relaxing the lower esophageal sphincter, and repressing the retroreflex in the stomach. So it all takes a long period of time and a lot of actual medical study and understanding your body and how to do it.
Has this study sort of persuaded you to give it up?
No, that was actually,
it needs to earn a living.
That's right. Somebody's got to do it, and there's only a few dozen of us left around the world today actively performing. So it's the Ig Nobel Prize has actually been a kind of a platform where we've gotten the word out that sword swallowing is, even though it's a 4,000-year-old art, that it is still alive and thriving around the world.
Blimey, that was quite a list. I wish you could see Nell's script now, because between us, we've all been scribbling various things. Nell, could you introduce us to your pioneering theory of efficient use of scrotal sac area?
I'm just interested. Ian sort of raised the point that it's funny that the bigger testicle is on the higher one, because you kind of feel that the bigger one should gravitationally be falling down. But I was thinking that if you've got a kind of sort of triangular sac, then the smaller testicle will edge towards the bottom. Or you just need to see the diagram.
That sounds like intelligent design to me.
I think we should move swiftly on from that. Jenny, you were also at this event. What caught your eye?
Well, I went on the night before, and what caught my eye was the Dutch just performing completely to specification. They only talk about sex. I think this is a proven scientific fact. We had the one guy who
bring
was
on the national stereotypes.
No, it was interesting. There was a guy who was studying.
Were they also smoking herbal cigarettes?
No, but he was eating a lot of soup. But that was another story. No, it was basically necrophiliac homosexual duck activity.
Oh yes,
which was quite disturbing.
Ian, what did you think?
I think it's good someone's got, you know, all those different dark corners of sexuality nailed down, and if anyone's going to do it, then, you know, hooray for the Dutch. I didn't actually stick through the whole tour. I grabbed my interviews and ran because I was slightly nervous around so many of them. Anyway,
there was a guy with a sword, I suppose.
A guy with a sword who wanted me to swallow it, and then when I said I didn't want to do that, he wanted me to pull it out of him, and I didn't want to do that either. And then there was another a grown man talking to me about testicles, another man talking to me about blinking, and Jim Goodlack, who talked to me very interestingly about the link between suicide and country and Western, and who has an amazing appearance himself. I'm sure he'll agree. It was fascinating, but I didn't want to stick around too long.
Well, first of all, what is the link? And secondly, tell us about this amazing appearance.
Okay, so he had a hat, which is fine, obviously, and then he had very, very, lot of hair, a lot of facial hair.
He's huge. Yeah.
A lot of facial hair. He's quite a solid guy. And then he had kind of, I thought it was like a kind of a skin on or something, like a Native American skin or something. It's like a leather toga, exactly. Quite vast thing. And
it's a bit like Hagrid with a hat on.
Yeah, kind of a little bit Lord of the Rings, a little bit Terry Pratchett, a little bit that, a little bit Hagrid, because he's a big man. But fascinating, absolutely fascinating. And you know, what I did genuinely love about his work was that this was absolutely fortuitous. They were just looking through, out of the data fell this association of higher suicide rates in particular parts of the country, which they then correlated with country and Western music. And he was talking to me about what the worst offending song, and it has an awful lot of drinking in. The wife walks out, the dog disappears, the sons never call, you miss the job you were trying to get at work, even if you could hold down the most basics of jobs. And all of these things just spin forward into this, you know, life of misery. And And it seems to have an effect. Have you listened to this all the way around? You know,
has it got a good tune?
I've no idea. I mean, fortunately, he didn't sing it to me, but he did say that if you played it backwards, then you would end up the happiest guy on the planet.
What can I say? It's grim down south. Fantastic stuff. Now, if you want to find out more about the Ig Nobels and support them, you can go to www.improbable.org. And also, if you're particularly interested in the homosexual necrophiliac duck, then you can trawl back through the archive, because we've got some choice clips of that from last year, I think, when Mark was on the show. It can turn the filthiest gunk into safe, drinkable water, and it's no bigger than a thermos flask. The Lifesaver bottle was one of several innovations shown off at an exhibition of military technology last week. Michael Pritchard's the inventor behind the device. He told me more about how it works.
Well, the Lifesaver bottle is, in essence, a filter, but it's quite a clever filter.
It's about the size of a thermos flask, I guess.
Yeah, it's 12 inches high, you know, holds as much as a bottle of wine. You take any old water, and I'm talking filthy, disgusting water that stinks.
I mean, what you're putting in there now is really not like a bottle of wine at all. It's got horrible bits of algae in it. And,
that's right. It's come from my pond, so you've got fish poo and everything else poo in there. It's pretty disgusting.
You can hardly see through the jug.
No, and it smells pretty. I know you can't smell on radio, but it really does have a...
Oh, yes. A very pungent pond aroma
exactly,
there.
Exactly. Sort of a young French Beaujolais. So you take that, you unscrew the base, you pour the water into the bottle like that. Now, in the field, you can just scoop that up. Okay? Yeah. You pop the top on. You flip the lid. Now, there's a pump in the base of the bottle, so I just one click... And there's my pump. I pull the teat. Now you can drink straight out of this or put it into a glass or a canteen. Give it a few pumps. And that's sterile water. Clean, sterile, drinkable water. Do you want a hot
grab hold of that? I guess the way to find out is to try it.
Yeah.
Tastes fine. Well, I guess we'll see whether I make it back to the office or not.
I was going to say just a little bit about the technology to sort of help understand that. The old technology is based on ceramic filters. Now, their pore size range between 300 and 200 nanometers. The smallest bacteria is 200 nanometers, so they're going to go through those pores. The smallest virus, on the other hand, is 25 nanometers, so they're definitely going through. My pores... The lifesaver pores are 15 nanometers, so nothing's going through.
And essentially, you've got a tube which the pressure that you put in pumps the water through those pores into the tube, and then what comes out the other end has gone through those
pores. That's right, so it's sterile water. So you just give it a few pumps, that increases the pressure inside the bottle, and that forces the dirty water through the membranes, sterilizing the water instantly.
And how often do you have to change the filter?
Every 6,000 litres. So to put that into context, if you drank 2 or 3 litres a day, you'd still be using it in 4 or 5 years' time if that was all your drinking water.
You're obviously marketing this to the military at the moment. It costs just under £200.
Yeah, £195.
But it could be used in all sorts of situations, couldn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Well, we've had Blacks contact us because they wanted to put it into their retail stores. But the main reason I invented it was for the aid market, the disaster market. One of the big issues is, how do we get water to people? Now, the old thinking has been we ship them water, particularly in the first days and weeks. Well, that's very expensive, logistical nightmare, but it's been the only way that they've been able to do it. If you take a C-17 transport plane, that can hold 72,000 litres of water. Right? That's enough for 800 people for 30 days. You can fit 125,000 lifesaver bottles on the same plane. At one per family, that's enough for 500,000 people for 16 months. When you put it into context like that, it really shows its power.
And are you thinking of sort of scaling it up to a kind of, you know, a water purification system that would be much larger, or do you think the benefit of this really is the small scale?
You hit the nail on the head. It's for an individual personal soldier use or a family use in a disaster zone or a hiker or a camper going out travelling. Because water is weight. 1 litre is 1 kilo. You know, it's a very heavy thing. But without water, we die. What this allows you to do is scavenge from the battlefield or scavenge from wherever you are out hiking or camping or in a disaster area, scoop up from whatever water source you've got and know that you can protect you and your family by providing them with safe, sterile drinking water.
Michael Pritchard there, and yes, I have lived to tell the tale. And incidentally, I was talking to some development people today at Oxfam and at AMREF who are involved in the Guardian's Katina project and saying... You know, is this going to take off in the development community? And basically they were saying too expensive, far too expensive at the moment. And actually in disaster zones, they don't fly in bottles of water because it's just too expensive. So I'm not sure whether he's onto a winner there, but I think maybe the military and the camping market could be a goer.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk.
Almost 50 years ago, the novelist and physicist C.P. Snow delivered his infamous lecture in which he argued that the breakdown of communication between the two cultures of modern society, the sciences and the arts, was a major stumbling block in solving the world's problems. Snow's main bone of contention was that most artsy intellectuals don't have a clue about thermodynamics and plate tectonics, and, well, scientists aren't so hot on their subjects either. So, has anything changed in the intervening half century? Here's comedian Robin Ince with his thought for the pod.
What is the point of studying English, or indeed most of the arts, or social sciences? I wasted most of my educational life reading novels and nodding at poetry. Does it really mean I understand beauty with a keener eye than a biochemist? If I'd gone down the real science route, I might know of quarks, quantum electrodynamics, or at least have a vague understanding of how something of infinite density and no mass turned into the universe we occupy. As it is, I can attempt a passing critique of Dombey and Son, or make the odd ribald comment about Beowulf. This also means I'm more susceptible to bamboozlers and charlatans with their magic crystals, chakra enhancers and water memory remedies. How would I know when Deepak Chopra talks of some quantum leap from a state of cancer to non-cancer that this is gobbledygook? Philip Larkin never covered that in the Whitsun Weddings. Can I really look a cosmologist in the eye and declare, well, you may have a solid grounding in Kepler's laws, but I bet you don't read a novel as well as I do. You probably don't even know what pathetic fallacy is. I'll leave the social sciences alone, but I mean, really, media studies should be a hobby, not a BA. Go home, read your Chomsky and note down the lies in the news, but it shouldn't really take 3 years to prepare yourself for that. If only I'd read science. I mean, I loved science as a child. I embraced my chemistry set and Carl Sagan's cosmos. But somewhere along the line, science became joyless. A series of dull classes and experiments involving the burning of peanuts to see the energy within them. Where is the joy and excitement? Think of Carl Sagan telling us that we are all made of star stuff. Or Richard Feynman explaining that an artist saying science made a flower a dull thing. That was kinda nutty. If only when I was 13 someone had told me that some, just 1% of the static on a TV screen is actually the background radiation of the Big Bang. And then when my mother could see me just staring at a television and saying, what are you watching? I could say, well, mother, I'm watching the beginning of the universe. For the last few years, as I approach 40, I've tried to immerse myself in the facts of the world and the worlds beyond and evolution like a boy opening his first copy of Look and Learn. But my brain isn't as absorbent as it was. It takes longer than it would have to soak up the information if only I hadn't wasted all that time on the arts. It's not to belittle the arts. I mean, enjoying an afternoon at the Tate or reading Kingsley Amis is supposedly good, but the world's media is dominated by people who consider grammar and punctuation more important than a universe-changing idea. It's time for science to grab us by the scruff of the neck and shake us from our pointless torpor.
That was Robin Ince there, and for anyone at home, I suggest that you don't embrace your chemistry set. It would probably be quite dangerous. He's touring at the moment, so you can check out his MySpace page, myspace.com/Robin Ince, and that's I-N-C-E. Lots of dates there. We've also put a link to the to an excellent article he wrote for us on the blog. Now, that monologue really fits in quite well with what we've been talking about, I suppose. Jenny, I mean, it's just what you were saying at the beginning about science not being represented properly in literature because, you know, idiots in literature don't know anything about science and don't think anyone else is interested in it.
Scientists in some ways are responsible, I suppose, because maybe they don't know how to talk about their subject in a way that's engaging. Some of my colleagues can be a little bit boring. But the thing is, most of us are really normal people. We love many of us love literature, love music, we're in bands, or we do art. We don't consider ourselves just scientists, but I think some artists or humanities types consider science to be something completely separate from their life. I don't know how to change that. I mean, he had a point that science classes can be really dull, and I think you lose a lot of people there. Just, you know, I suffer through a lot of dull classes.
No.
Don't you think, Mel?
I find I have a group of friends who are mainly arts graduates, and so I'm a sort of a science, get looked to for science queries among them. But the thing that you really find is that people do want to have scientific questions and things, and it comes up in the course of everyday conversation. And I think it's a bit unfair to say that people in with sort of an arts background aren't interested in science. I think they are. It's maybe just an access. they?
Yeah, possibly.
I find something incredibly patronising about the whole idea of the concept of public understanding of science and in some aspects of science communication, where there's this assumption that we think it's interesting, we're right, so we have to go and tell people about it. I think in life you go through, you find things which are interesting, which are across the board, and then you find out about them because that's how you get your enjoyment. And I think if there are people who don't find certain aspects of science interesting, then I don't really see why it should be for us to sort of herd them along and say, come on, it's interesting, really. Sod it. I think, it's interesting to people who like it, and just carry on like that, I think.
I guess it has consequences sometimes. If you don't believe science or you don't believe in medicine, and you say you have a child and you want to get him inoculated or not. I mean, in some ways, it's good to know a little bit about science and to trust what science is telling you. Maybe scientists aren't always right. You can look at things like the atom bomb, and terrible things have happened because of science, but not because of scientists, but because of the application of the knowledge. And I think it would be great if people would know a little bit more so they can make better decisions about the technology and the science that we have today, as MMR.
But isn't it down to them? Isn't responsibility on their shoulders to find out?
The child who's going to, the 2-year-old kid who's going to be inoculated, it's down to the parents.
Yeah, exactly.
So I don't know. I do see your point. You make an excellent point, but it wouldn't hurt if more people were interested in science. They don't have to be interested in science, but it'd be so nice because there are interesting things about it.
But accountants say the same thing, and so do Christian rock bands.
Come on.
And it's just. I think there should be an aspirational part of it. Look, I think if people want to find out about it and realize how interesting it is, then put the hours in and find out. Work it
like
yourself.
I'd like you to find for me an accountant who eulogises their subject.
Oh,
Christian
no,
rock bands,
because
yes.
Come on, they're interesting.
They're
people
everywhere.
Always have questions about pensions and their income and how it works.
That's not because they're interested,
but
it's because they have
interested,
to be.
And they do kind of want to know.
No, they don't. Everyone's boring. Everyone knows it.
Any reason I know anything about my pension, which is only a tiny amount, is because you kind of have to, isn't it? Oh, let's leave that one there. Well, we're in danger of becoming the accountancy podcast. Well, we're done for another week. So my thanks to Ian Sample, Nell Bowes, and our special guest, Jenny Roan, for talking with such eloquence and excellence. Head to blogs.guardian.co.uk/science for links to the other things we've discussed this week. We'll be back next time with our non-Easter Easter special, featuring, amongst other things, a new song by our troubadour, Johnny Berliner. We don't know yet what it'll be about, so why not suggest something on our Facebook wall, and maybe he'll use your suggestion, maybe he won't, I don't know. Science Weekly's been produced by Ben Green, and his dad's an accountant. He doesn't know very much about science, that's Ben, and he's also Irish. So happy St. Patrick's Day. Top of the morning to you. I'm James Randerson. See you next week.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.